Okay, to summarize briefly what we mean by the existence of the soul, we mean as follows. The existence of the soul can be demonstrated from the fact that in the universe there is a physical, something physical there that we sense, we can perceive with our senses, but behind the physical is the abstract world of ideas. And the world of ideas and laws of nature are what really govern nature. So everything is produced through ideas. Those ideas do not change. They are eternal. The human mind can tune into that world and recognizes that world as the real world. Now that proves that there's something in the human mind that can partake of the eternal, which itself, of course, must be of the same nature. Therefore, that part of man is the eternal man, and the eternal part of man. And that's why that part is not subject to destruction, because it's not physical. That's really what we mean by the soul. Okay, and that's why we say that Tselem Elokim, the in Genesis, where it says that the divine image of man, that's what it means, the divine image. All the interpretations state that it means the knowledge and intelligence of man. Okay, knowledge and I just like to okay, so that is the part, that's the divine element of man. That's the part that's not subject to destruction. Okay, now I'd like to. Just to mention something, which I know sometimes it's a kind of a stumbling block. Like people say, well, you can have an intelligent person that knows physics and science, and yet it could be evil. All right? That is true. Nazis were evil, and yet they had science. But the answer to that question is, when we say knowledge, and this is important, when we say knowledge in the Torah, we mean knowledge with regard to everything, which means with regard to how a person should live. That is just as much knowledge, if not more important knowledge, more primary knowledge, than knowledge of the universe. Okay? And therefore, when we say a man lives according to knowledge, we mean in every way and in every respect. And there's a knowledge of ethics, which the Torah teaches us, and a knowledge of how to live, the proper way to live, and that knowledge is what, when we say knowledge, we mean total knowledge, okay? Not just the knowledge of a subject. A person could have knowledge of chess. This doesn't make him perfected. Knowledge of mathematics does not make him perfected. Even knowledge of physics doesn't make him perfected. But it's a part of the whole realm. When a person has total knowledge and recognizes the whole world of knowledge, including that part of knowledge which teaches a person how to live, that means that everything they do is based on knowledge. Their whole life is surrounded by knowledge. Then the soul is functioning completely, and then they will live according to the Torah. Okay? Now, what I'd like to do is just get back to this point, okay? The point is, a little bit abstract. The concept, it goes like this. And by the way, the good that we speak about is the soul's existence after death. That is the ultimate good, because that's when the soul's perception increases, and the depth of knowledge increases as well. That's why when God told Moses, he says, for man, Moses wanted to know God's essence, because he had reached such astronomical heights of knowledge. So he said, show me your essence. And God said, no, because man cannot know my essence and live. That meant to say that as long as he's alive and he's tied to the physical, he cannot reach that abstract level. But after he dies, then it is possible. It will be possible for Moses to perceive, to have a perception, not only of the actions of God, but even to some degree, of his essence. Okay? Now, because the soul is freed from the bonds of the physical. The physical is always a limitation in our life. It limits the power of the soul, the sight of the soul, and it removes this union. Removes any kind of tending pleasure that the soul would have. Now, in the afterlife, the soul is freer. Its perception is clearer, better, more abstract, and also it has it gains the pleasure of its own function. Now, the way we could what Maimonides means is the answer to the contradiction I mentioned before is that Maimonides means no one can know the afterlife because it's the experience is impossible to have while we're alive. So you can't know it. That's what he means when he says no one can know it. But when he says that the greater a person is, the more of a knowledge of it he has, he means, of course, a person can have a knowledge of it by way of understanding, not by way of experience, but by way of thought. Okay, now what I'm going to do is just go a little bit into that, because obviously Maimonides means a real deep thinker will have a sound idea of this, and a person that isn't will have at least some concept of it, okay? First of all, a person has to know what's meant by knowledge, because if you don't have a concept of what knowledge means, so then you obviously are not going to have any concept of what the afterlife is, all right? Now, there is, however, an example that we can give, which would, by way of an example, you'll be able to see a little bit as to what is meant by the afterlife. If you notice, every creature has, when it functions properly, has an attending enjoyment. In other words, if you take a cow you give it its needs, so it is in a pleasurable state. All right. If you take a human being and give him his needs, he will be in a pleasurable state. Now, the pleasurable state of the human being is far superior to the pleasure of a cow. Everyone recognizes that an animal might be contented. You see, we call it contented, really. But man is capable of extreme excitement and pleasure, all right? And that's because man is a superior, a higher form of existence than an animal. That's why he's capable of a higher kind of enjoyment and pleasure. The lower you go in the animal world, the lower the concept of pleasure is. The higher, the closer to man, the closer. There's a big. Then all of a sudden you reach a tremendous gap. When you reach, let's say, the primates. Okay, so you reach a higher level of animal behavior and existence. But then there's that big gap between any animal and the human being with his mind and his intelligence and his different inner experiences. The inner experiences of man are far wealthier. They're actually different, completely different than the inner experiences of animals. And there is a greater enjoyment because there is more psychic energy. It's a higher kind of existence. Now, the soul itself is the highest existence. So all Maimonides is saying is that that everything that exists, when it functions properly, has an attending enjoyment, an enjoyment that is with it, that experiences. The higher the existence, the higher the enjoyment, and the soul, which is qualitatively differentiated, must have the highest kind of satisfaction when it functions freely. Therefore, man in the afterlife, when it's just the soul functioning, okay, experiences the greatest satisfaction, which is satisfaction which is qualitatively differentiated from other satisfactions that we experience, which are psychological satisfactions. And in this way, a person can at least get some kind of a vision of what is meant by the enjoyment that exists in the afterlife. It's the satisfaction that attends a higher kind of existence, which is man's soul. Okay? Man's psyche is higher than the animal, and that's why it's capable of more pleasure, but man's soul is qualitatively differentiated, because the psyche is really just variations of the instinct. But the soul is a pure existence, something which is tied to the eternal, completely different. And when that functions freely, the attending enjoyment and satisfaction supersedes qualitatively any kind of experience of enjoyment that we could have in this life. Okay, so in that way, we could present some kind of an inkling and some kind of an approach as to what we mean by what the prophet means when he says, what is this great good? How great is the good that you have hidden for those that fear you. That is the great good. And only God knows what that good is. Man, through his mind, can get an inkling of it, but he's kind of like a construct, sort of, but he can't really have a direct knowledge of what it is. Okay? So in this way, we come to understand in an intelligent way what the Torah means by an afterlife. I'd like to just show you from the Torah itself, from the prophets itself, what is meant by an afterlife, and we have allusions to it, clear allusions to it, if you just use your intelligence to understand the verses. But first, I want to deal with a major question. All right. Now, this major question I'm dealing with is not just a question for those who believe in the truth of Torah, but it's a question that has really stunned every person who's tried to analyze Torah, whether they were historians or religionists or mythologists, any people that approach Torah are always stunned by one amazing fact, and that is that the Torah mentions nothing overtly. The five books of Moses mentions nothing about an afterlife. Okay? Now, at one time, historians thought, well, it's very simple. You see, the rabbis made up this idea of an afterlife centuries later. But originally, in the original Torah, there was never a concept of an afterlife. And these are historians who do not believe that the Torah is true, but they certainly don't believe that the rabbis. From the most primitive, I mean, from the American Indians with the happy hunting grounds, the most primitive, I don't mean that that's the most primitive, there are more primitive religions, but the most primitive religion always has an afterlife. And at the time when the historians, conclusion, they drew that conclusion, they weren't aware of it. But then as they studied other religions, they found out that there aren't any religions that don't have an afterlife. And once psychoanalysis started to investigate it, it was discovered that an afterlife is part of man's unconscious mind. It's part of man's primitive mind. It's the fantasy of immortality, which exists in every single human being, with the exclusion of none. Just like there are no people without a heart, there are no people without an unconscious, which has a fantasy of immortality. Fantasy of immortality is expressed on a daily basis in numerous ways. Every person has that fantasy that they're immortal. But now, once that's known, now we have a very, very big problem. Because if the Torah is not the Word of God, it would come out that somehow these people living 3,000 years ago were able to avoid the most primary reason that people are religious. And it just sounds crazy. How could these people deny such a thing? Why would they deny such a thing when everybody else in the world accepts it? And that's the main motivation of all religious life, is really, they sell you heaven. Heaven is what religion is selling. How could Torah be exempt from that? Psychologically, it does not make any sense, all right? So it's a dilemma, really, for the person who studies the Torah and who believes the Torah is true, but it's a big dilemma, unanswerable dilemma, for the person who doesn't believe the Torah is true and tries to study the Torah purely from a historical standpoint. Okay. Now, what do we say for this great problem? It's a problem for those who accept the truth of Torah also. Why didn't the Torah mention anything about an afterlife? When we understand what afterlife means, you'll see why the Torah never mentioned it, okay? And this is precisely everything we've been discussing the past 3 weeks now kicks in and as part of the answer. You see, to this big dilemma, and the answer really is based on what we said, straightforward, quite straightforward. The answer is you have to remember that although Maimonides explains that people do things for ulterior motives, and you don't always remove the ulterior motive until you can supply them with a true motive. Now, that's just common sense, okay? If a person is following a doctor's advice for the wrong reason, and if you know if you tell him it's wrong, he's not going to do it, you don't say anything. You let him go on till he gains enough intelligence to know that the physician is the one that has the answer for him. Same thing is true in Torah. That's purely logical. But you must remember that the Torah is the word of God, and everything in the Torah can only be true. Okay? Now, if the Torah would have mentioned an afterlife, then what would happen? People, when they saw afterlife, they would immediately think not the true afterlife of that requires speculation, all right? The afterlife that we've been discussing, Maimonides explains, but they would immediately think that there's something better than the Torah itself. That the Torah is not saying to do the good because this is really the good. The Torah is saying to do the good, why? Because you're going to get paid back in an afterlife. They're going to think of an afterlife which is a payment, all right? The kind that Maimonides explicitly outrules. That is the afterlife of the man-made religions, you see. The so-called happy hunting grounds where you get paid back for what you did and what you suffered in this life, okay? That would be false. If God would have written that in the Torah, then man would be living a false life, okay? Man would be, perhaps he may even do the commandments with greater fervor if God would have. No doubt if God would have written that in the Torah, it would be more inspiring. But that's not true. And because it's not true, the Torah did not wish to influence man with a false notion. Because then people would think the good is not the Torah itself. The good is something that God's going to give me in return for suffering and for keeping these laws. But the Torah tries to make it perfectly clear that the laws themselves are the good. Now, that is true, because the laws are good for man in this world as well as for his soul, because since his soul is perfected, so the soul continues its existence hereafter. But you don't even need the hereafter in order to keep the Torah, because the good of the Torah is good right here and now. This is the only way to live a good life, a life based upon knowledge and the system that God gave man. So that is the reason why the Torah avoided mentioning anything about an afterlife. Now you have to look at it this way, a little further. The Jews had come out of Egypt, okay? The Jewish people came out of Egypt. What was the main preoccupation of Egypt? The main preoccupation of Egypt was death, afterlife. Everything in Egypt rang from an afterlife in one way or another. The pyramids, everything that was done, servants were taken with them into the afterlife. Giant tombs were built for the wealthy people, the people of high status who were able to afford such a thing. And the other people, no doubt, looked on with envy. But everything was done in return for an afterlife. So their religion was based on this concept. The Torah took the Jewish people, God took the Jewish people out of Egypt, away from this kind of living where people did things for death, and he gave them a Torah which taught people to do things for life because this is good. So the major thrust was to show man, and that's the thrust, to show man that the good is in itself the good. That's what the Torah says in many places. You'll do the commandments. Why? L'tov loch, so that it should be good for you. This is the good. There is before you death and life. Choose life. It means if you do this, then you're partaking of life. So a person who keeps Torah does not keep Torah because of an afterlife. That would be saying that there's a compensation for everything I'm doing, which means I'm doing things which are not really good. I'm just doing them because I want to get a greater compensation. But that's not true. The truth is that the Torah, which is the true system, teaches man to do this because it is good for you. If you don't do it, you're harming yourself. Okay? That is why the Torah never mentioned an afterlife, because it didn't want to mislead people and cause people to do things for an untrue reason. That would be harmful, you see. That would be harmful. So the Torah told man the true reason. Do things because of the good itself. However, that's enough reason to do it. The concept of an afterlife is a deep philosophical one. The Torah does not expound overtly on deep philosophical principles. That was left for the oral law. the oral portion of the Torah is the part that deals with the more abstract science. The science of Torah is always in the oral law. So there you have derivations from verses and allusions and the whole system of the oral law, but the Torah itself overtly does not deal with abstract concepts because it's made for every, even a casual reader, to be able to read through it and it makes sense, okay, on a basic level. But the deeper level is where the oral law comes in, and that's why the concept of an afterlife, which is a very deep philosophical concept, with the 3 weeks that we've been discussing it, we're just scratching the surface of it, and the Torah does not write, record such kind of ideas, because that's not for the written law, that's the area of the oral law. Okay. Just give me a second here. Are there any questions?
I don't think we have questions. I could just add a qualifying statement.
Yes.
In there, in relation to the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, mm-hmm. that there's nothing in them dealing with the afterlife.
That's right.
Because in the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, the emphasis is on the here and now and quality of life for all of humanity in this world.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's correct.
By bringing ourselves under the control of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, then we are actually elevating ourselves in the spiritual realm, mm-hmm. or elevating the soul, as you've been.
That's correct.
You've been saying. So.
That's correct. I would just add one thing. I remember what I wanted to add, and that is there is, however, allusions to it. And I don't mean just allusions, but I mean open statements which are unexplainable unless one understands the idea of an afterlife. That you do find in Torah. Of course, it's in the Ecclesiastes, as I mentioned before, it mentions that the soul returns to God, the body stays in the earth. But aside from that, in Psalms, you'll always find the term, and in the Torah, in another place, you find the term Sheol. Sheol. What does Sheol mean? So David says, God will not allow me to go into Sheol. Sheol is used many times in Psalms, as I'm sure you're all familiar with. Now, what is this Sheol? No one seems to know what it is. Historians, Bible critics say, well, it's the grave. Well, was King David stupid? Did he think he's not going to die? I mean, it doesn't seem so. On the contrary, he seemed to be very, very realistic when his death approached. He called Solomon, and he instructed him, and he said, I'm dying, and this, I accepted death. What does it mean? Does it mean that he went to the Sheol? What is Sheol, really? See, Sheol is a vague concept. But the idea of Sheol, and it doesn't. There are no descriptions of a Hades or a hellfire or anything like that. What Sheol means is what Maimonides explains, and that is, you see, Sheol implies destruction. What it means is the soul that has not elevated itself, it simply disintegrates body, and that's it. It's God. That is Sheol. Sheol means that when if a person's essence is just the physical, then at the time when he dies, there is nothing that survives. Everything just goes into the grave, and that's it. So Sheol does mean a pit and a grave. But what King David was saying is that God will not allow me to die in a way that my soul has not reached its proper perfection so that it can continue to exist. That is what he means by when he mentions that God saves him from Sheol. And it's the same thing that he means when he speaks about his enemies, and he says that God will not allow his enemies to prevail over him because God will save him from Sheol. He doesn't mean from an immediate death, because if a person does not get killed by his enemies, he's still not going to live for much longer. I mean, the man's in his 50s, 20, 30 years maybe. So he's not going to escape. What he means is what the Torah says, because the Torah says, Maimonides explains this, that when the Torah speaks about the punishments that the Jewish people will suffer if they don't abide by the laws of the Torah, so Maimonides explains that these punishments are not in themselves bad. What's bad about them is they prevent the person from spending their time properly in pursuing the perfection of the soul. Because if a person is being chased by their enemies, and if a person is sick, and a person has all kinds of problems, then their day is spent just trying to survive, and not much time, he doesn't have any time or much time to spend on perfecting the soul. Then the person goes down to Sheol, because there is nothing left that survives. You see, that's what King David meant. When he spoke, and that's what he meant when he says also that the dead cannot praise God. What does he mean? The dead cannot praise God. Well, of course, a person's dead. Does he mean physically? Does he mean that there's nothing survives the grave? No. What he meant was praising God means where a person is perfecting his soul in this world through his proper attitude towards God, his recognition of God. In the next world, it's a different kind of a state. The next world is a state where the perfection that the individual gained in this world remains with him. The afterlife is a result of this life. But you cannot make any gains in that, and you cannot make any qualitative gains in that at that time. The gaining that a person has to do to perfect his soul is right here and now. If he doesn't perfect it here, then he simply goes into Sheol. That's what's meant by the concept of Sheol. If you understand that concept, then when you read Psalms, you'll see how it fits, how it all fits in. The praising of God, for instance, and we mentioned that once before, it uses that special name, the abbreviated name, the Y and the H, because that is the name that is used to direct one's emotions away from the instinctual and towards the recognition of God. That kind of phenomenon only exists in this life. See, in this life, we have the choice to redirect the energies towards the true source of all existence, God. In the next world, you don't have that choice anymore. Then whatever you have established in your soul, that is the level that the person stays on eternally. They have different experiences. It doesn't mean it's a static kind of a thing. The next world is not the afterlife is not a static kind of a thing. It's an activity, but the activity can only reach a certain realm, a certain qualitative realm. That realm is the realm which a person has accomplished with his soul in this life. Okay, so that is what is meant throughout by the term by that term Sheol.
Rabbi, okay. We got less than a minute, and hope we don't run out this time.
I'm really finished.
Okay, well, that's good.
Okay.
Well, we'll cut you off then.
All right.
Not to Sheol, though.
Okay.
All right.
By the way, next week, I won't be giving class. Next week is Purim.
Right.
And you're all invited to come up here and join us for Purim, and I'll supply the scotch and guarantee the question.